You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
So I think we're going to get started. Welcome to the Brookings Institution. My name is Ben Wittes. I'm a senior fellow in governance studies here, and I'm going to be very brief on the introduction side because I want to leave as much time as humanly possible for the substantive discussion that we're going to have here today. Thanks for coming on very short notice, and as you all know, the president gave a major address this morning on signals intelligence, the NSA, and reform of the authorities and policies in connection with the Snowden disclosures. These issues and the speech raise just an incredible array of discrete policy and legal questions. There are the domestic authority questions, civil liberties questions. There are foreign policy diplomatic questions. There are internet governance. There are U.S. industries which are losing very large sums of money as a result of loss of confidence in overseas markets. And there are privacy questions. And so one of the remarkable things about the Brookings Institution is just the array of people that we have working on various components of stuff that relates to this and, you know, across a number of our programs. So we worked with the Foreign Policy Program to put together this very quick event in which we're going to offer some a bunch of different reactions from different parts of the institution. Keep in mind, the speech was only given very recently. It covers a wide range, and so I think a lot of what I'm going to say today, I think, is still relatively tentative, and some of my thoughts may be in subject to change over time on that. I sort of want to be candid about that up front. With what I think we're going to do is each of us, starting with Bruce and then Cam Carey and Ian Wallace and then myself, will speak briefly, give some overview thoughts. We'll have a brief exchange, and then we'll try to leave as much time as possible to take your questions and go in whatever direction you all want to go. We have a Twitter audience as well. People will be tweeting in questions, so if you see me being handed little slips of paper, I hope those will not be things telling me that I've been completely wrong and I should correct myself, but they will be questions that people are sending in. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Bruce.
Thank you, Ben. And like you, I think they are trying to give a very preliminary reaction to what is a really large amount of data we got here today. We have a speech, we have a document, and we have backgrounders. So we have a lot of material to work with. I would characterize it as a very good speech. I would characterize it as classic, maybe even vintage Barack Obama. This is a man who we all know to be very deliberative, very thoughtful, who likes to reach out to as large a group as possible. And he's done that in this process. If there's a message here to his handlers in the White House, I would say it can be summed up in, let him spend more time in Hawaii. It's very good for the deliberative process. I'm not going to try to go through the whole process and every document. I would just highlight a couple of things up front. I think the emphasis here is on transparency to the extent possible and oversight, rather than fundamental changes in the collection programs that the NSA is carrying out. Those programs, as I see them, remain largely intact with a few fixes, but with more transparency to the extent that's possible in secret programs and more oversight. The presidential policy directive that accompanies the speech, PPD-28, is, in my judgment, unprecedented. In 2 hours, I couldn't really check, but I don't think we've ever had a document like this that lays out the protocols, principles for American signals intelligence collection. And I think that's good in two respects. It's good for the American public, the global public, to be able to read it and see what those principles are. And it's good for the National Security Agency, because the National Security Agency can see what we did was legal. It's allowed under PPD 28. And, of course, the biggest issue, as we've all heard, the Section 215 collection of megadata, we largely have a punt. The question of who's going to hold on to that data is going to be resolved by looking at it for the next 60 days or so by the DNI and the Attorney General. This is a very complicated, very difficult issue, rightly called the hot potato of this problem. I'm not sure 60 days is going to come up with a solution, but I think 60 days is probably enough time to identify whether there is a non-U.S. governmental entity with the capacity and the financial willingness to carry this out. One last thing I would stress from the overview. As the President said in his speech, and as was made very clear by his aides and their backgrounders, the President has found no abuse of authority by the National Security Agency. And he said that over and over again, and his staff has said that over and over again. They found no evidence of an abuse of authority by the NSA. Where they found mistakes were made, they also emphasized those mistakes were corrected rather quickly. That's a pretty important judgment to put out there. Let me deal with a couple of questions that were on my mind before the speech was made and how I see the President responded to those questions when he made the speech. First of all was the question, how did he portray the National Security Agency in particular and the American intelligence community in general? Did he portray them as the nation's defender? After all, he's been on the job 5 years. This is his team. Did he embrace them? Or did he distance himself a little bit from the NSA, as we've heard some unnamed White House advisors do over the last couple of months, saying, well, maybe they didn't do something wrong, but they were kind of out of sight and maybe a little bit out of control. On this, I think the President was clear and unequivocal. He identified the National Security Agency as the spiritual son of the Sons of Liberty and Paul Revere in 1775. I can't imagine a better description in the eyes of Fort Meade than the one the President gave him. He called them the World War II codebreakers of today. The whole first 5 minutes of the speech was about how the NSA is protecting our security, our liberties. He even went further than that. It's protecting the security and liberties of people around the world. Now, an awful lot of people aren't going to believe this. But it, A, is a powerful morale booster at Fort Meade, and B, is a powerful anecdote to so much that you hear out there about the demonization of NSA and the American intelligence community. How many movies, how many TV shows have you watched in which it looks like the NSA is spying on everyone, keeping track on everywhere you go, with no controls, with willy-nilly oversight? And the President pretty much said firmly and categorically, all of that demonization by Hollywood, by television, by parts of the media is just hogwash. Secondly, how did he characterize the effectiveness of these NSA programs, especially Section 215? Over the course of the last several months, we've heard a lot of attempts to defend them in terms of foiling various terrorist operations. The President was here, I think, a little bit on more shaky ground. He said multiple attacks have been thwarted, but he gave us really no examples of that. That's understandable. A lot of secrecy has to go into this. But it's again going to raise the issue, can you actually provide us some data that backs that up? The only specific he launched into was September 11th. And he said if NSA had had the megadata program, it would have been able to realize that when Khalid El-Mihtar, one of the 19 hijackers, called home to Yemen, he was in San Diego. The problem with opening up that Pandora's box is that we know that the CIA knew he was in San Diego. The problem here wasn't the intelligence community didn't know about it. It was that one hand didn't tell the other hand. I think this is an area where probably the administration will regret having opened up the Pandora's box. But in any case, it's not really crucial to the President's statement today. Third question on my mind ahead of time was, what's he going to say about Edward Snowden? Is he even going to mention Edward Snowden? There were many who thought that Edward Snowden's name wouldn't come up. In fact, it did come up. It came up very clearly. And the President made his views on Edward Snowden pretty clear, as he has before in the past. Edward Snowden is not a whistleblower in the President's eyes. He's a man who violated his secrecy oaths. He's a man who leaked information in a sensationalistic and often incorrect way. And most importantly, Edward Snowden has put out information there which the President said will harm our national interests and our capacity to collect intelligence in the future for years, if not decades, to come. The president, in effect, associated himself with the remarks of British intelligence chiefs, including the head of MI6, John Sawyers, who, in asking the question, "What has Snowden done?" responded, "Al-Qaeda will be lapping it up for years to come." That's pretty strong words, and the president came out pretty close to the same area. Last question that was on my mind ahead of time was, what about the so-called no-spy deals? Are we going to expand the so-called Five Eyes Agreement, in which the U.S., U.K., Canada, Australia, and New Zealand share intelligence and agree not to expand, not to spy on each other? There wasn't a word on that. The question of would some other country now qualify to be in a no-spy deal never came up. I'm not surprised. This administration has been dealing with this issue since it came into office, and it has consistently said, forget it. We're not going to do that with anyone else. There is agreement that friendly allies, heads of state, but only the heads of state, will not be spied upon. And we're told that a couple dozen or so have already fit into that category. I would suggest one of the great guessing games of 2014 at various international summits is going to be, am I in the good guy category that doesn't get spied on, or am I in the bad boy category that still does get spied on? It's a very important question, actually, not a trivial one. How do you make those kind of determinations? And does behavior over time change whether you're in one category or another? What the president has done in setting up the PPD is said there's going to be a constant review of that process at the highest levels of the American national security bureaucracy. One last point I would like to make, and that's, I think it's worth remembering that only a few months ago we had a similar big speech on drones. And that speech on drones a few months later has often been, is a good one to look at in comparison today. And because a lot of the things that were talked about in the drone speech are still works in progress. The transfer of drones from the CIA, the Department of Defense, it'd be charitable to call it a work in progress. And secondly, a lot of it requires the Congress. And for example, in the question of transfer of drones from the CIA to the DOD, the Congress has said, no, we don't think that's a good idea. We're not going to go that route, Mr. President. So this is a stepping stone. This is a first step. There are a lot of material to work with here, but an awful lot of this yet has to be translated into implementation, and a lot of it will depend upon what Capitol Hill wants to do.
Thanks, Bruce. Before we go on, I just want to, for those of you standing in the back, there are actually a bunch of seats in the front, few rows, and I would urge you to sit down and be a little bit more comfortable. Cam?
Thanks, Ben. Well, I agree with Bruce on the tenor of the speech. The president began with, as Bruce said, a strong defense of intelligence gathering, and then ended it with a strong defense of American values and the importance of America upholding those values. And I think the sort of testament to the balance that he was able to strike there is I can tell you that in the room with a sizable portion of law enforcement and intelligence community there, as well as a number of privacy advocates, that both groups went away smiling. I focused on certainly the what this says to the international community, to our allies in Europe in particular, but also around the world. And what it says for privacy issues, what it says for internet governance. Because at the end of the day, as great as the impact on intelligence gathering may be, I believe that the impact on trust in the United States government, trust in the United States companies, trust in the United States developed model of internet governance has been far greater, and that has had enormous economic, diplomatic, and policy fallout. And you know, there, I think the president accomplished a great deal. And I think went further than expected in declaring that we are going to extend protections to non-U.S. persons, to non-U.S. nationals, regardless of where they are, and articulated a set of principles that will apply to signals intelligence gathering involving non-U.S. citizens. Many of those are principles that have already been applied by the intelligence community. But the significance of having those in a presidential policy directive, as Bruce says, the first of its kind, goes far beyond that, and I think will resonate with the international community. It is a statement by the president, the highest levels of policy, and it is binding, and it is public. So those are all important things. And the president and the presidential policy directive declares that everyone is entitled to dignity and respect for their privacy, regardless of where they live. It also goes beyond some of the existing policies in articulating a set of criteria for what constitutes legitimate intelligence gathering, related to nuclear proliferation, terrorism, et cetera. And that, I think, helps to not only provide some reassurance and trust, but to advance the international dialogue on norms in digital space. The president alluded to that, and I think has sort of helped to kick that off. But I think the important thing here on that score is that the United States has taken a lead here in defining what is legitimate national security protection. That is a key piece of international norms discussion. Every country collects intelligence and conducts some forms of surveillance for national security purposes. The key element of that debate is, all right, what are the international norms that define legitimate national security protection? The president has put down a marker on that, has put down a marker saying that the United States, regardless of what other countries do, is going to bind itself to a set of norms. So that is an enormous step and something that I think will advance the discussion and help to repair some of the short-term damage and in the long term to help to begin a serious discussion rather than a sort of view with alarm discussion, serious discussion about international norms.
Thank you. Ian?
So conscious of what you've already heard, I wanted to draw attention to three things that the president really didn't emphasize in his speech and I think may have been significant for that. And that's not necessarily a criticism. There are things that are deeply complicated and you maybe wouldn't expect them, but I think there are things that will continue to fester within the wider Snowden debate and to remind ourselves of them is an important part of situating the context for the speech. First of those is the organizational questions, which to some people's surprise were reasonably prominent in the review panel's report. That there are a few organizational ideas or proposals, I guess, decisions in the PPD about the oversight, new position at state, new position at the White House, changes to the committees that oversee some of the intelligence gathering, but not so much focus in the speech as some had hoped on how the collection is organized. There were proposals in the review report, for example, for taking the information assurance function away from the NSA, which personally I think would probably have been a mistake. And there was plenty of discussion over the last few months about whether the NSA commander and the Cybercom commander, which currently dual-hatted, should be separated. And that decision was clearly, or that opportunity was clearly not taken by the president. I think that reflects, to pick up Bruce's point, an endorsement of the operational significance of what NSA provides, potentially over and above the potential presentational benefits of doing that. And that may reflect the fact that he thinks he got those presentational benefits from some of the other measures that he took. One of the ideas that was floating around was this concern that certainly within the US system, possibly in contrast, for example, to the British system, where this hasn't become, certainly hasn't become such a public issue, at least not to the same extent in the United States, is the fact that the political risk owner is not necessarily the person who has the benefit from the intelligence, and questions of whether you could designate NSA as a foreign intelligence organization and take away some of its military functions to sort of clarify that. And that was largely not focused on in this way, and I think that whole issue may continue to rumble on. But again, I think, take Bruce's point, this was an endorsement for the intelligence community's way of doing business. Second area was the whole issue of cryptography, question of whether the National Security Agency prevailed upon NIST, the standards setters, to weaken cryptography to make it easier for NSA to spy on people. And there's certainly been a lot of concern within the cybersecurity community that this was a breach of trust on behalf of the US government. So for example, a large number of quite significant security consultants have said they will not attend the RSA conference, big cybersecurity conference next month, in protest at the idea that RSA may have taken some money to weaken some security standards. And, you know, the important thing to note here is the internet is heavily dependent on the geeks outside government in order to operate, and undermining their trust and the wider cybersecurity community, I think, is going to be something that the government has to work hard to regain. That wasn't addressed here, and that probably is a reflection of the fact that there are no easy answers to this tension between counterterrorism and cybersecurity. It's not been particularly explored within the public dialogue because there are no simple answers. Again, I wouldn't expect to see answers today, but I think that's another reason why this isn't the final word on this issue. And finally, the other area that wasn't particularly emphasized was internet governance. This is going to be a crucial issue going forward this year because of a big debate that was already happening before Snowden between countries who wanted to maintain the current international oversight mechanisms, which involve private sector, civil society, as well as governments, and another set of governments who prefer a more governmental approach. And I think the concern was that with Snowden, many of the governments sitting between these two camps were beginning to distance themselves from the United States. There is a lot more to do in this, and I wonder if whether simply setting up a position at the State Department is sufficient to take that forward. But I also tend to agree with Cam that by publicizing, if not particularly changing, the basis on which foreign nationals' data is handled, by changing the way in which foreign leaders or policies governing whether they're surveilled, will actually help some of those governments who themselves are engaged in signals intelligence activity and need to be able to find a ladder to climb down their criticism. Now it begins to be exposed that they are engaged in similar kinds of activities. That may help them get out of that fix and allow the US government to take forward a more positive engagement. It will not, however, alone solve all of these problems. I think it gives a basis on which the US government can change the dialogue and can re-enter the norms debate in hopefully a more active and potentially more positive way. Bottom line, therefore, this is a basis to move forward. I don't think it's the end of the story by any means.
Thanks, Ian. So I am going to do two things. I want to talk a little bit about the tone of the speech, amplify on some other things that have been said already. And then I want to geek out a little bit about the substantive legal authorities that the president talked about in a number of areas. So I very much agree with I think the speech was sort of a surprisingly strong endorsement of the essential activity of the intelligence community broadly and of the NSA in particular. And I say surprisingly not because, you know, the president is, has cast doubt on this in the past, but because he has actually been under enormous pressure. The review group that he appointed came out with a series of recommendations that were quite dramatic, really, in the scope of the reform they were proposing in certain respects. And I think he really did have a choice to make today, whether he was going to be somebody who essentially came in and, you know, saw an out-of-control intelligence community under his watch and was going to be the guy who reformed it, or whether he came and described it as a situation in which there was lawful and important intelligence collection activity taking place in his administration, i.e. his administration, his intelligence committee community, and that certain changes were needed to increase the perception of legitimacy of that lawful, appropriate activity. I think he very solidly chose the second option. And I think, you know, up until relatively recently, what direction he was going to go in that was somewhat in play, at least according to, you know, news stories and sort of other signals and trial balloons. So I think that is a notable thing, just a sort of high arc. And in particular, I want to focus on one thing that he said that I think will was I'm sure not an accident that he said it, and really reflects a anxiety in the intelligence community that is pretty pervasive and pretty, you know, very strongly held. And I think it'll mean a lot to a lot of people that he said it. There's a portion of the speech, and I should have highlighted it and just read it, but where he said, you know, these are people who work every day knowing that the next time something terrible happens, they're going to be asked why they didn't connect the dots. And I think identifying with that dilemma, that these are, that when you talk about removing authorities, the anxiety that this engenders is the anxiety of people who believe that they will be held accountable for not having exercised the very authorities that were taken away from them. And I think the president actually, you know, it was quite a savvy thing to include a very specific reference to and identification with the dilemma that the intelligence community is in on a basically hourly basis as they decide what authorities to use and not to use and how aggressively. I want to talk briefly about three substantive areas that the president addressed in the speech. The first, the 215 authorities. Second, the 702 authorities, which are the overseas content collection. And third, the total victory of the FBI and the Justice Department on the matter of national security letters. On 215, this is, of course, the molten core of the political debate. It is actually not the molten core of the issue that faces, either from my point of view, the intelligence community or the civil liberties community, which is to say, this is a comprehensive collection program, but it's a comprehensive collection program aimed at a very narrow category of data, which is to say, telephony metadata. And so its capacity to either do great good, as Bruce described, or, frankly, to do terrible damage in the civil liberties arena is actually much less than either collection under 702, which I'll come to in a minute, or collection under Executive Order 12333. It's just not that broad-based a program in terms of its in terms of what gets collected and analyzed and how. So what the president did here is he basically said he basically adopted in a limited sort of way the review group recommendation, which is to say, move the program outside of government, and allow it to be queried. Keep the capability, but allow it to be queried with an order of the FISA court. The problem is that, of course, that's actually very easy to say and very hard to do. And so what he did, which it's clever, and the question is whether it's too clever by half, is he said, all right, well, we'll implement part of it now, which is to say we're going to limit the number of analytical hops people are able to take right now. I can do that on my own. He also said he could do on his own, requiring that they get an order from the FISA court to query it. I actually don't think that's right, and I'll be very interested to see if the FISA court buys that. I think I have a feeling the FISA court's going to look and say we have no statutory authority to entertain such orders. But then he says, okay, and we're going to study the problem of how to really move the data off-site until for the next couple months, and then we'll work with Congress to figure it out. And what that basically means is I'm going to do minor reforms on my own, and then if Congress can sort of design a system, or we'll give them some guidance about what we think they can do, but if they can implement a larger system, great. And by the way, if not, you know, he doesn't say this in the speech, but we can keep living under the existing authority. So I think, you know, there's at one level, this is a adoption of the review group recommendation, but at another level, it does not seem to dramatically impede the ability of the agency, at least in the short term, to collect and query when needed with appropriate supervision the data in question. 702 strikes me as an even bigger win for the agency. 702, unlike 215, is a massively important program, and it is a bread and butter collection program devoted to overseas intelligence targeted at non-U.S. persons. And Cam is absolutely right that the president, for the first time, and it's a very important statement at a kind of spiritual level, that we acknowledge that non-U.S. persons have privacy rights in the context of our overseas collection. That it is very hard to overstate the sort of spiritual importance of that statement. The practical importance of that statement may be dramatically less than the spiritual importance. And the reason is that, you know, the intelligence community actually doesn't collect and disseminate willy-nilly stuff about overseas targets that has no foreign intelligence value. They don't do it not because it's illegal, but because it's a total waste of their time. And so if you have a program and you limit it and you say, okay, now foreigners have privacy rights in Belgium or in Tajikistan, and we're going to have minimization rules that only cause us to disseminate material of foreign intelligence value. I suspect that is not going to cause big problems either in any foreign intelligence agency that's doing its job with minimal competence. And so I actually think this might be an area where the spiritual statement goes a long way without actually changing very much. And it will be very interesting to see what documents, if any, get produced that over the next few months that implement this at a more granular level. Finally, one of the big surprises in the review group report, because it wasn't a feature in any of the Snowden leaks, and it actually doesn't involve NSA, involved the FBI's acquisition of national security, issuance of national security letters, which are demands in national security investigations to telecommunications providers to turn over certain basic information. And these are done without without prospective judicial review, and they're done actually at a fairly junior level, a fairly low level of the Bureau. And they're quite controversial. They have nothing to do with the Snowden leaks. And the review group, I think it's their second recommendation, quite high up in the review group report, said this stuff needs to be subject to prospective judicial review. This did not go over well at the FBI. And the FBI, unlike the 215 program, which is, you know, a few hundred orders a year, queries a year, this is thousands and thousands and thousands of requests. So this is really part of the daily bread and butter of FBI activity. There was a real interagency squabble over this, and the Bureau won. The president actually sounded a lot like, in his speech, sounded a fair bit like the FBI director did in a discussion that the New York Times reported on, some other media reported on a few weeks ago, and basically said it shouldn't be harder to get these phone records for the FBI in a national security investigation than it is for a U.S. attorney or assistant U.S. attorney to get bank records in a criminal fraud investigation. So I think that this is an area that was a little bit lower profile and doesn't relate to Snowden, but actually turned into a pretty significant interagency dispute. And again, the intelligence community came out of it pretty much where it would want to be, I think. So I'm going to stop there. And if you have questions, hold your hand up and wait for the mic to come. Sir.
Thank you so much, Martin Klings of the German Weekly Die Zeit. Bruce, I heard you that not mentioning the non-spy agreement means actually also a lot. I do agree. I just listened to the speech and at the Justice Department, but I have a question. What does it mean, the extension of privacy rights to foreigners? What could it mean? You, Ben, just said the spiritual effect might be bigger than the practical effect. But what privacy rights could be extended to foreigners? Are they thinking about the Privacy Act of 1974, or what could it be? Thank you.
Cam, do you want to treat that first? Sure. I have some thoughts on that, but go ahead.
Well, there are a set of procedures that are outlined in the Presidential Policy Directive. Data minimization, data retention limitations, and potentially, by implication at least, limitations on how databases are queried, where the operative principle is that the same procedures, the same policies, will apply to U.S. and non-U.S. persons. So that's where the operational significance will be. A lot of that is TBD because it's delegated to the Director of National Intelligence and the Attorney General to put those procedures together. I guess what I would add in the sort of broader structure of things is, one of the recommendations of the review board that the president adopted is ensuring that considerations of privacy and civil liberties, of commerce, international trade, of internet policy are part of the discussion. And that's embodied in the PPD. And I can tell you, as somebody who often was one raising those issues in discussions here, that is an enormously valuable thing. It is not that people in law enforcement or the intelligence community aren't attuned or receptive to these issues, but they are not built into the discussion. Now they are. Now they are as a result of the substantive criteria that are in the PPD, and they're there as a result of, you know, the review procedures looking at intelligence gathering, at the priorities, at the targeting, through the National Security Council Deputies Committee and Principals Committee, with ultimately approval by the president. You know, that ensures that, you know, a wider set of eyes and considerations go into the implementation of intelligence gathering. So those, I think, are important steps. And but, you know, to what Ben said about, you know, this validating what the intelligence community has done. I mean, as one who's looked at these from the perspective of those other issues, I think this came out in the right place. In terms of the structure, in terms of the limitations, it's not everything that the review board recommended or that some have advocated. But where I think I do differ is on the significance of metadata. It is potentially highly significant. One of the rich avenues of research these days is what you can learn from social networks. Come back here on the 18th of February, Sandy Pentland from MIT, who's one of the leading scientists in this area, is going to be here to talk about his new book, Social Physics. But, you know, what's key here is what you do with that data, how you manage it. That will be made more robust. But I think the validation of sort of what the intelligence community is doing is because there has been a strong set of protections in place. As coming from a different perspective, at the end of the day, I would not structure a lot of the privacy protections that differently if I were in the IC making those decisions. This is really because there are a robust set of protections in place. They are being more robust, being made more robust. They are being broadened in terms of the scope of who they will cover. But so in that sense, it is a very much a validation of what has been done. Gary?
I just want to suggest...
Please identify yourself.
Rick Limpert, Emeritus Professor, University of Michigan. I want to suggest that the devil is not so much in the details here as in the bureaucracy. I spent some time at the Science Technology Division of the Department of Homeland Security, NSF, so I've seen some of these bureaucracies. And just to give two examples, Obama, near the start of his administration, issued an executive order on classification, which in essence said we were classifying too much and that we should err in the direction of, if you will, of openness. I certainly have not seen evidence that the bureaucracy picked up on that directive in any realistic way. Second example, department, and this deals with the implications of this applying U.S. privacy law overseas. DHS, in fact, did that. And at least in some experiences I had, there was research that we wanted to do, which would involve the collection of PII, personally identifiable information, on a very small number of foreign individuals who, I'll just say it was quite legitimate to do this research. There were great delays, and indeed some research of this sort may be thwarted. I think, given if they really are applying the U.S. Privacy Act and its rules about what may be collected and held, there could be more significant effects, particularly realm of doing research into issues that may help us. Okay. Over
can we,
time.
Can we bring this to a question, please?
Yeah. Well, I'm just making comments. This is the end of the comments, and I throw it open, particularly to your reaction. If you want a question, how is the bureaucracy going to be able to transform this? Are they going to be able to transform this? Will this be accepted and followed?
So just to clarify on the privacy front, the review group actually did recommend a DHS-like policy-level application of the Privacy Act to the extent, as a policy matter to non-U.S. persons. The president's speech does not do that, at least not as I read it. It talks about recognizing that non-U.S. persons overseas have privacy rights, but it does not do it with reference to the Privacy Act. And so I think it's actually a bit of a step back from the recommendation of the review group.
Can I add one thing to that? I think it's an interesting question about bureaucracy. The big winner out of all of this in terms of enhanced power is the DNI. And when we think about it in historical terms, when the DNI's office was set up about a decade ago, it was very clearly intended that this was to be a small office with a small staff without its own building, which would largely be a coordinating role. Well, here's one more step in the increase of the DNI's authority. The DNI now is on par with the Attorney General in establishing all of the bureaucratic mechanisms that kind of flow out of this, which means that the DNI is not going to have a small staff. He's going to have a pretty big staff. He's going to get into privacy issues that he's probably not gotten into a whole lot before. It's a, as you say, it comes down to how does the bureaucracy go about implementing this, and I think the question here comes down very much to how aggressive will the DNI's office be, how big will the DNI's office be, will it be able to work with other agencies, will the NSA listen to it? I think it probably will. It's a winner for General Clapper and company at the DNI's office, in short.
Gary.
Sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead, Ian.
Please
bring the microphone over to Gary while Ian's talking.
Just very quickly to say that I think one sort of comment on how the bureaucracy operates is that the bureaucracy is going to be under a lot of scrutiny. I mean, just to pick up on Cam's point about the idea that commercial interests are going to be brought into the decision making, everyone accepts that that's going to be a good thing for U.S. power more generally. But it's more important in this area, perhaps, than some others, because the private sector have to be convinced that that is really happening and in fact rather than just in theory. And if they don't, they won't engage, and the U.S. government will be not able to operate through the sort of soft power that the U.S. tech sector delivers. And that's going to be really important for delivering some of its national security objectives through the internet governance debate and one thing and another. Similarly, I think the international community will be watching some of this very closely. I think Obama has given himself the opportunity to change the nature of some of those international debates and move things forward. But if there's a sense that what is happening is not what he has promised, then they will move back from that, and that will stymie progress. So I think there's going to be a fair amount of scrutiny on this going forward, which will keep the bureaucracy on its toes. Yeah.
And if I could add one point on to your point about sort of changes in the bureaucracy, one other thing that the PPD does is to say that there will be a privacy officer at OMB and that the Office of Science and Technology Policy will also appoint somebody who will coordinate with the DNI. And that's, again, something else that ensures that, you know, there's an additional perspective and that kind of brings one of the main points of contact with the tech community into the intelligence discussion, the intelligence oversight.
Gary, this time for real.
Okay, thanks. I'm Garrett Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report. And I want to not let a comment that two of the first two of you on the panel Bruce and Ben made. I want to check it. Both of you did a kind of at the outset said, don't write this in ink. I'm going to need some time to think about this, and my views sometime down the road may change. And I want to ask whether that is, whether there is more than a sort of generic, wise, this all happened this morning, I need to get ready for this afternoon observation, or whether perhaps I was A, surprised, and B, slightly swayed by how well he did what he did, or were there components of what he touched on that raised some yellow flags for you? I think Ben specifically talked about FISA court jurisdiction relative to Section 215 as one example. So was this a sort of general hold on, folks, or were there some places where yellow signs might be flashing?
It's a very perceptive question, at least in the psychoanalysis of me. I can't and won't speak for Bruce. So in my case, there are a number of areas that I am at this point aware that I have not analyzed with sufficient thoroughness to know what my stable opinion of them is actually going to be. Let me just flag them for you. I'm not entirely sure I understand what the implications of the privacy rights, acknowledging privacy rights for non-U.S. persons overseas is. And I think I'm not sure we will understand that until you hold up Executive Order 12333.3, Section 2.3, against existing minimization procedures, against the minimization procedures that they're going to have to write for this. And there's this little phrase in there that says, as Cam pointed out, that these have to be the same as the minimization procedures for U.S. persons to the extent feasible and consistent with national security. Well, until you put all those puzzle pieces together, and I understand how feasible it is consistent with how much national security and what those minimization, how similar and how different they're going to be, I'm going to be a little tentative in how I react to that. There is also a part in the speech where the president says that he's, suggests some reforms of U.S., of 702 vis-a-vis the incidental collection of materials on U.S. persons. He does not elaborate what he means by that, and in fact sort of punts it to, I believe also to the DNI, to go back to Bruce's point. I'm going to want to see what that looks like. Are those reforms, substantial and encumbering, and are they privacy protective, or are they incidental and unimportant? And so I think there's a bunch of stuff that's just, you sort of see the chapter headings here, but what they're going to mean in the granularity of practice is very much to be determined. There's probably also some stuff that it's very clear what it means. I just don't understand it yet.
I'm not going to psychoanalyze myself. What Ben said, I think, applies. I'd just highlight two other points. There's a fair number of places in the speech and in the document where there is language which you could drive a truck through. For example, they can't seek out megadata except in emergency situations. Well, what is an emergency situation? That's a judgment call. And one of the points the president was making about this whole thing is, we don't need to just think about the judgment of this president. We need to think about the judgment of the next president, the president after. And when you have a lot of those rather loose formulations, it's a subject for worry. What would a next president do on something like that? And then I think there's the other question of throwing it to the Congress. But maybe I'm just influenced because I'm reading Bob Gates's book right now. But his characterization of the Congress as the uglier it is, the closer you get, the more ugly it is, certainly applies to our current situation. And the notion that this Congress is going to be able to come up with creative and useful solutions to some of these very, very difficult problems strikes me as the triumph of hope over experience. I just don't see that happening. And that's a worry. We could find out that instead of a path forward, that's a path to nowhere.
Yeah, I guess I'm not going to psychoanalyze either Van or Bruce. And I guess what I would say is I've had sort of very similar conversations, one after the event with people there, and then another with as we were preparing for this discussion, both sort of trying to parse exactly what the president said about the 215 program and you know, where it's going from here. So I think that's going to take some additional analysis and sort of parsing of the PPD, the language of the speech, and you know probably some further explanation as well.
Other questions?
Yes, thank you. I'm Laura Ballard. I'm with the U.S. Department of State. I used to work with Cam Carey. I continue to work on a lot of these issues, and it's good to see Cam mm-hmm. again. But I have a question, really, I'm voicing on behalf of sort of the bureaucracy, because I am a career federal bureaucrat, and it really goes to the climate in Congress and Congress's willingness to reform. To my experience, oversight costs money. Transparency costs money. If the president issues an order to improve transparency in government, but the size of the FOIA offices doesn't increase, you get pretty lackluster results. Judicial review requires more judges and more people to argue in front of those judges. And so on the one hand, we're hearing a lot of new mandates being placed on some of the very people that work on oversight on these issues now. Some of those very people are subject to furloughs. They have been sent home on furlough. The independent review group was forced to stop working for 2 weeks because of the government shutdown. So from the Congress, do you see any recognition from them that oversight, the desire for oversight can be expressed with commitment of resources? Or is there a danger that we're going to just see a new set of unfunded mandates and a requirement on agencies to sort of rearrange the deck chairs another way to try to make it happen and possibly in lackluster fashion? Thank you.
So I'll offer a couple thoughts on that. The short answer is no. Congress, you know, the congressional oversight, and this is a very dangerous point in this area because these are, you know, highly elaborated, highly they're very dense statutory schemes that were put together with just enormous care over many, many decades now by Congresses that worked better than the current Congress does. And the care and feeding of the FISA regime, which has gone through just, you know, several, you know, a great many rewrites over a long period of time, because technology changes so quickly, it actually requires regular revisiting, not just for the oversight reasons that you describe, but also because the technology changes and it becomes out of date. And Congress's, the point that Bruce made about Congress is absolutely right, and it is in this area devastating that, you know, it every time it gets harder and harder and harder to reach a point in which the Congress can work in a bipartisan fashion, and this legislation always has to be bipartisan, on a technically dense area of enormous legal complexity. And that's getting harder and harder. And when you layer on top of it the need to create these oversight mechanisms that the executive then has to interface with, the workload burden is enormous, and it's actually a real problem. Yes.
Hugh Grindstaff, have you heard anything about what Mike Rogers, Dutch Rupersberger, Dianne Feinstein, have said about it. And in a way, what bothers me, the NSA situation doesn't bother me. Hackers bother me. And I had access to the information before. But I really feel that the DNI now is from Booz Allen. The previous DNI works at Booz Allen. Snowden worked at Booz Allen. Are we giving too much power to corporations to have the access to this?
Well, this gels very nicely with a question I was just handed from one Brandon Andrews, who writes, do you think Americans feel more safe with phone metadata in the hands of private companies or the U.S. government? And if so, why? So I throw that open to any of the panelists.
Let me begin on that, because I was one of the architects of the administration's privacy blueprint and consumer privacy bill of rights. I certainly would like to see progress move forward on that. We do have a significant issue with the private sector as well as with government. I think in many respects, those issues are the same. In a big data era, collection is going to take place. We are moving into a world of ubiquitous computing. We need to figure out how to deal with that in the context of government collection, whether it's metadata or other data. We need to deal with that in the private sector as well. It has certainly been a difficult environment to do anything on that front while the Snowden disclosures were out there. Obviously, wouldn't sit very well for the administration to come and say, well, you know, we really ought to do something on that, the private sector collection. I think maybe now we can put some of this in the past. We can't put all of it in the past. There's a lot of other documents out there, and we'll have the PCLOB report next week and other things that will continue this discussion. But at least we may have reached a point of deflection that we can now look at the private sector issues as well and begin a discussion of how do we manage that collection? How do we ensure that is appropriately protected in ways that meet consumer expectations and ensure that harms to choices that people want to make and to their lives don't get affected.
I'm tempted to say, are you safer at Fort Meade or are you safer at Target? I think the answer is you're a lot safer at Fort Meade than you are at Target for the average American in terms of what really matters to him. You do raise, I think, though, in addition, a very important question, and it also relates back to the question of bureaucracy. Unless the Congress of the United States and the executive is prepared to enhance the strength of the career professional service, most of these issues are going to be outsourced to contractors. And we will see more and more security evaluations and more data collection handling in the hands of contractors. And if I think there's one lesson of Edward Snowden, it is that's a big mistake. That is a really big mistake. How does a fairly junior contractor in Hawaii find a way to download the top secret budget of the United States intelligence community and nobody in his office seems to notice that he's doing this? Right. It's outrageous. And the Congress should have long ago called up Booz Allen and others and asked them those questions and made them do something about it. But I don't see that happening. I think, unfortunately, the Congress is part of that contractual world, too. When congressmen and senators move on, where do they move on to? The board of directors.
And then Paul's statement, too, Barry Clapper and Snowden.
Right.
More questions? Yes, sir. Oh, oops, you're next.
Hi, I'm Yannick Lemieux, cyber attaché at the Embassy of Canada. So the speech was mainly in reaction to the Snowden disclosure. Do you see this speech having an impact in changing, giving the U.S. government a higher moral ground in this debate, or do you see it as being likely a dud in the long term?
Ian? Do you have thoughts on that?
I do. I mean, I think almost, and probably sensibly, I think the U.S. government is moving away from having a sort of basing its policy on moral authority in this particular regard. What I think this speech will do, at least in the context of internet issues and international tech issues, is provide a basis on which the government can now start proactively engaging internationally in a way that it probably felt a little bit inhibited before. There's enough in the speech to allow other governments to engage with the U.S. If they feel, you know, that it's in their interest to do so in a way that they can sell back to their own publics. And I think how that actually translates into outcomes depends on how the administration takes that opportunity and what it follows up with. I mean, I happen to think that the U.S. actually has enormous, on a sort of larger scale, enormous moral authority when it comes to the internet governance debates, for example. The values on which the internet is built and has driven the success of the global internet, sort of openness, freedom, a more multi-stakeholder, is far more attractive and should be more attractive to people and countries around the world than the more authoritarian model with lots of government regulation. But I think people have been stepping back from the United States because of Snowden, and this may open up that dialogue and hopefully will start the process of building a coalition around a better way of taking the internet forward.
Yeah, I agree with what Ian said. I'm tempted to answer the question, yes, it gives the United States greater moral authority, but I don't think this is really a matter of moral authority. Alexis de Tocqueville said that the greatness of America lies not in being more enlightened than any other country, but in her ability to repair her faults. And I think in this discussion, in sort of laying out a set of procedures, laying out a set of principles, creating greater transparency, that the president has established a model that really puts it to other countries around the world. And I think he was quite pointed about that. And certainly one of the effects of the Snowden disclosures and one of the things that I think has tempered a little bit some of the international outrage is that the press in other countries has been asking the question or looking at some of the Snowden documents to find those answers. What are our countries doing? What are our governments doing? And so certainly a number of countries have had disclosures about their own activities that has caused them some embarrassment, most notably maybe Brazil. And, you know, there, I think that's enormously helpful in the discussion about sort of norms and governance. Dilma Rousseff said at the UN that we need a multilateral system of governance of the internet. Well, we have one today. It's just that it happens to be a largely non-governmental one, and many countries would like to put this under government control that's more respectful of government interests, more respectful of borders. This helps, I think, to move the discussion back to a better model of governance.
I'd like to actually gently disagree with I think it's worth really drawing as sharp a line as is possible, and it's not completely possible, between the internet governance questions, which do actually rely in a profound way on moral authority, and espionage, which is a deeply amoral exercise in which we all pretend to be outraged by the things that are done to us and pretend that great moral principles lie behind our ability to do it to the other guy. And I think that at the end of the day, there's a lot of feigned anger as well as some real anger. And I don't believe that the loss of moral authority in the espionage space was ever quite that great. And I actually don't believe that this will do much to restore it. Because I think the real issue, with respect, again, bracketing the internet governance side, which can be hard to bracket, is the real issue is a whole bunch of stuff got found out that is embarrassing to us and disadvantageous to us to have out there. And that's not fundamentally a moral issue. It's fundamentally an embarrassment and unpleasantness and diplomatic ramifications and business ramifications issue. You had a question, sir?
Thank you. Tom Curry with NBC News. On Monday or Tuesday, when Cass Sunstein testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee with the other members of the panel, he drew attention to a recommendation that the panel made that he said hadn't gotten really any notice at all, and that is to expand NSA's authority, give it emergency power when a terrorist suspect who's been under U.S. surveillance outside the United States enters the United States for the first 72 hours, give NSA authority to track that person. Did the president address that, and how significant is that?
So the president didn't address it, and I think you can assume that the reason is that if you're giving a speech about imposing new restraints, by the way, asking for new authorities in the context of that speech is a little bit dissonant with the larger message, as in fact it is dissonant with the larger message of the review group report. There is a group of compliance reports from NSA that suggest that the problem of what are called roamers, which are people who are legitimate subjects of intelligence collection overseas, and you wake up one morning and you find out that they're in Cleveland, and all of a sudden the collection's illegal. And so what we do now when that happens is we shut them off, and those show up as compliance incidents in these reports. And it's a fairly common cause of compliance problems. And so one possible way to think about that is to say, well, there's no problem. When it turns out that surveillance is illegal, we shut it off and they notify the FBI. And another way to think about it is it's a huge problem. There's compliance issues and the NSA is behaving illegally. And they're doing all this illegal surveillance, which is the way some of the press has covered it. They just count it as among incidents of illegal surveillance. A third way to think about it is, hey, it's a policy problem. We're turning off surveillance of the most dangerous people. These are legitimate targets of overseas collection who show up in the United States. These are exactly the people you should be worried about. And the review group took that position toward it, and I think rightly. And I suspect that the president will not talk about this very much publicly, but I wouldn't be at all surprised to see the Senate Intelligence Committee or the House Intelligence Committee take a very hard look at that recommendation.
Would that require legislation?
Yes. Mm-hmm. We have a couple of questions that came in over the transom. Which are the most significant review group recommendations that the president didn't mention? So Ian, these go to the sort of molten core of what you were talking about. Can you distill what's the most significant thing in the internet governance encryption space that the president didn't say, and what should he have said about it?
So I actually think it's less. I don't think we have good answers on the cryptography issue, and I defer to others who may have better ideas. And I think that may be why neither the review panel particularly or the president got into that space. Where I think he did not engage, and it's a whole group of issues, is on the future of the structure of the NSA. We have potentially an opportunity coming up with General Alexander moving on to do a number of structurally different things, either certainly to split the NSA from U.S. Cyber Command and give the NSA a more explicitly foreign intelligence function, taking away sort of military issues. You could, in support of the sort of international détente that the administration's involved in, put a civilian head at the top of that organization. You could conceivably take the NSA out of DOD, and it's not said in the review recommendations, but it's sort of vaguely hinted at.
And there's the separation of information assurance from SIGINT.
Absolutely, and I think what you got from the speech was the president saying this would have a short to medium term operational impact, which I'm not willing to take, and that I don't think the presentational advantages of that are necessary given the other things that I'm doing. It remains to be seen. If you think of the speech as basically an endorsement of the current arrangements with a number of measures to mollify key constituencies, we'll have to see how those constituencies react to that. But I think the cybersecurity community on the encryption and indeed on the structures will probably still feel that he needs to move a little bit closer towards where they are.
Mm-hmm. So another question from Twitter is, how significant are the reforms the president proposed to the FISC, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court? I suppose I can answer that. Mm-hmm. So there were a few. One is this idea that the FISC should approve specifically every query to the metadata program. That is a significant reform to the metadata program, and depending on how many requests, how much it brings down the number of requests, it's actually a significant workload burden for the FISC. The Judicial Conference, which is currently the executive of it, is a former head judge of the FISA court itself, John Bates, wrote a letter earlier this week to the Senate Intelligence Committee basically saying the review group reports are a mammoth workload burden for the FISC, and some of them you shouldn't give us, and some of them, if you give us, it requires a lot more resources and more judges. So, the 215 program is relatively small in terms of the number of queries, and that's certainly a manageable burden for the FISC, but there is an institutional impact there. The more significant impact, the president endorsed a public advocate before the FISC. He was, I think, very intentionally vague when he did so about what exactly he was endorsing. There are two basic visions of what a public advocate could be. One of them is basically give the FISC the authority to appoint amicus counsel to argue against the government's position when it feels it needs an adversary briefing. Unsurprisingly, this is the vision the FISC favors, that the Judicial Conference favors. They want the judges in control of that. The more expansive vision, which has been in some of the legislative proposals as well as in the review group, is having a standing office, public advocate, that gets to intervene when it wants to and argue against the government's position. The president's, words can be sort of read to be either or just kind of leaving that question up in the air. And I think that's one of the things he's punted to Congress, basically. How significant it is institutionally is largely a function of what Congress does with that. Yes, sir.
Matthew Powers, Competitive Enterprise Institute. There's been a lot of talk about Congress acting on a lot of these reforms. Congressman Justin Amash communicated several months ago, though, that Congress doesn't receive a lot of information directly from intelligence agencies, that they're very obscure in responding about some of the programs that are going on. So what is the likelihood of any reforms on that front?
Anyone have thoughts on that?
I'll take a hanker at it. Yes, the Congress and many congressmen and senators have long complained that if you don't ask the question precisely in the right way, you get a very misleading answer. I don't think that that's going to go away. Intelligence communities, secret intelligence agencies, collect secrets to have a secret, not to give them away. And the Congress of the United States has not established a track record on very sensitive operational secrets that leads anyone to a great deal of confidence that they will maintain that secret. Drone bases in Pakistan as one example. That said, I think one of the things that the president has done here by endorsing the NSA, by calling them the 21st century Sons of Liberty, is he's given them the mandate to go to the Congress and say, here's what we're doing. It's entirely legal. We have new documentation that says it's legal. And we're going to tell you what we're doing. The problem of getting agencies to answer the question, even if the question isn't rightly phrased, is usually, not always, but usually been a bigger problem with the Central Intelligence Agency than the National Security Agency, because NSA's programs are for the most part ones that can be articulated to Congress fairly simply, whereas a lot of CIA, especially covert action programs, there are elements of it which are going to be at risk, serious at risk, if misinterpreted or loose lips put them out there in the public domain.
In the back.
Mike Nelson with Microsoft. One of the things you haven't talked about is the president's promise to have a high-level group led by John Podesta looking at big data. And I'm curious, what two or three questions would you hope that group would try to answer? And do you think within the year we'll have another Obama speech on the broader question of big data and privacy? And will we have a Brookings panel on that speech?
Well, the second's obvious.
We've had many panels on that subject, and I'm sure we'll have more. Does anybody have thoughts on the on this?
I'm certainly very interested in that inquiry. It's frankly not clear either, from the PPD or from the speech exactly what the scope of that inquiry is going to be. It's on a fairly short timeline, which I think is going to make it challenging to address those issues. But, you know, as I said before, this is an important issue, important conversation to have, both on the government side and on the private side. I think, we are at a stage in this world where we can't just focus on the issue of collection. It is going to take place in ways that are beyond all of our conception. Today, and as you know, is expanding at an enormous rate. I think on both the government side and on the private side, we can't just say stop the collection, we can't just disregard data that's available. It's sort of like dealing with replay review in baseball. It may be nice to say we just want to disregard the information that's available. But there are going to be times when you wish you had access to it. And there are enormous gains, enormous risks, and we need to focus on how we manage that data. And I think we've certainly had a discussion from the president on that today, and I want to see the discussion move forward on that on the consumer side as well.
So we have time for one more round. Why don't we take questions and just we will go down the panel for final thoughts. So if people have questions, let's get them out on the record now.
Hi, my name is Anwar. I'm a student. Throughout the years, we've seen profiling and surveillance, whether it's de facto or de jure, with the Muslim community in particular and other groups of color. Moving forward, do we see any protections against this type of profiling with surveillance, specifically with the NSA, but with other types of surveillance in general? Especially, I mean, the president mentioned it very, very, very briefly. But yeah, again, do we see any of these protections moving forward?
Okay. I had one over here.
Thomas Stevenson, also a student at George Washington University. So would the NSA or would Cyber Command take over the security of our armed forces instead of, like, if the NSA was removed from military operations?
Okay. Anybody else before we close the question floor? All right. Ian, a brief wrap-up from each of y'all.
So a specific answer to the last question. I mean, the three roles of U.S. CyberCon, one is specifically to look after the security of DoD networks, the other two being to support commanders, and the third, which is some way the most difficult and challenging, is to defend the nation and how that engages. So CyberCon has that responsibility. I think the challenge that would arise from splitting the two is that a lot of the intelligence that Cyber Command needs to do its work comes from the NSA side, and splitting the two out would be highly inefficient. That inefficiency may be worthwhile in the long run, but in the short term, I think the judgment is it's not the benefits do not justify that inefficiency. General sort of wrap-up comment. I think what is not being commented on too much, but is also worth sort of getting on the record, is one the interesting aspects of this speech is President Obama directly confronting the international aspects of this, which hasn't been part of the administration's presentation to date. So when you have the DNI sitting in front of Congress saying, This is only affecting American citizens. However factually accurate that might be, you know, over 6 billion people around the world say, you know, actually, I'm not one of those. And I think the way in which the president came out and directly confronted these issues is helpful to taking this forward.
So on the question of profiling, one of the principles that the presidential policy directive has made explicit and made universal is that the United States shall not collect signals intelligence for disadvantaging persons based on their ethnicity, race, gender, sexual orientation, or religion. And I think that along with many of the other things here, I go to the point that Ian made. We have here the president speaking out on these issues. When the Snowden disclosures came up, the president said he wanted to have a national and a global conversation about surveillance and about privacy. It's a conversation that he wanted to be very engaged in, and I think that's reflected in the choice of a review board of people who were very trusted by the president and who used their trusted position boldly. And he has not endorsed all of those recommendations, but he's certainly taken them on board. He has certainly engaged in a vigorous way in that conversation, and I hope that can be a tipping point to move forward in some very substantive ways on the broad set of issues that we have here.
Well, as I said at the beginning, I think one of the big contributions the president has made here today is in taking away this image of an out-of-control, rogue national security agency, and I think that's a very important step. There are two things I'm looking towards seeing next. One is, what happens when there is another terrorist incident in the United States, a repeat of Boston or something like that? As Ben rightly puts out, the president acknowledged that, and I think he's acutely aware of this. He's had been very lucky for 5 years, very lucky. His luck isn't going to go on forever and ever, and our luck collectively isn't going to go on forever and ever. Now, will there then be questions, why are we wasting time going to courts when we know there are terrorists in the United States? And that is a matter of time. The other thing that I'm going to be looking for is, what's the next shoe to drop from the Edward Snowden apparatus? What are we going to hear from his network of supporters? In the course of his revelation so far, there's been a pattern of orchestration that has been quite interesting. You get a leak about Germany just when we're about to go to Germany. You get a leak about Brazil when the Brazilian is just about to come here. I think he may have tried yesterday to get a similar effect. I don't think he got much of a bounce. We'll see. And the other question is it really Edward Snowden who's doing this? Or is there a larger apparatus? I know that many people in the intelligence community who are looking at this issue now no longer regard Edward Snowden as a thief or a traitor or those things. They regard him as a defector who's gone over to another foreign intelligence agency. That's a very interesting question, which we don't have a very good handle on. But let's see what comes next out of Moscow.
So I very much agree that a lot of the next few months will be conditioned by additional disclosures. Have we reached the point where each additional disclosure has less and less impact on the debate? In which case, I think you could really imagine this presidential speech combined with a certain apathy in Congress or a lethargy in Congress beginning to be the sort of tail end of this set of scandals or controversies. The other possibility is that the disclosures continue and they maintain a certain fevered pitch in large segments of both the conservative and liberal bases that really condition the congressional politics and keep them alive in a way that is can be very unpredictable and very, I think, sort of dangerous if what you're trying to do is bring stability to our understanding of what authorities will and won't exist, should and shouldn't exist, what should be written in law, what should be policy, what should be fluid, and what should be fixed. Finally, and I will close here, the other big factor is the fact that the Patriot Act authorities, including Section 215, do sunset in a little less than 18 months. And so in the short term, if Congress doesn't do something, what happens is that the president maintains all the authority that he has, including vis-a-vis 215, subject to whatever additional constraints he puts on himself, some of which he did today. But in the longer term, and the longer term isn't really that long, that default switches. And if Congress doesn't do something, the 215 authority actually goes away in, I believe, May of 2015. And so one of the questions, and I think we'll leave it here, is do the politics settle enough that you could have a congressional enactment that says this is the portion of this program that we will endorse beyond May of 2015? And does the review group recommendation, as articulated by the president today, embraced sort of by the president today, provide a formula for that longer-term stability or not. Picture strikes me as very different if you think that that recommendation and the president's discussion of it today provides a basis for settlement of that issue than if you believe it doesn't. Thank you very much for coming, and come back.